Christian Fitzpatrick's stories have appeared in journals such as Colorado Review, Southeast Review, Epiphany, and many other journals that have rejected my stories. She grew up in Michigan and now lives with her husband in Southern California. My Pulse is an Earthquake was selected to be performed on stage by New Short Fiction Series in LA's longest-running spoken word series. Kristen, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You know, it's been how many years since I've seen you? I think the last time I saw you was it the class that we had together?
You know, I think there was one other time. It was about 3 years ago at Fresno State when they had that wonderful event for Phil Levine. You were there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. In fact, I was looking at pictures of myself back then, and not to be egocentric and make this show about me, but I was fat.
I wouldn't say that.
It was a very comfortable time of my life. But yeah, that's why I last saw you. When I heard about your book, I was very excited. And please don't, whatever you do, give me 100% responsibility for your success. But you were in a class of mine when I was the visiting writer at Fresno State. You were in my graduate fiction seminar. And some of the stories in here, you workshopped in that class, didn't you?
I did. I sure did.
That was a long time ago. Tell me about how it came about from that time or from the beginning to the end of this wonderful book, My Pulse is an Earthquake.
Thank you. Well, yeah, that was the beginning. Actually, that line, My Pulse is an Earthquake, comes out of the story that I wrote in your class. That was the first story I wrote.
The story with Kiko.
Yeah.
I remember her. Yes, yes. In fact, her story is still in here.
Yes, it sure is. Yeah, and the name of the actual story is different. It's called Representing the Beast. But I started with her, and I just kept going. My project at Fresno State, my thesis, was a set of linked stories that were all revolving around this other character, and I decided to try to write one story from the point of view of all the people in his life. And what happened is that they all became much more hungry for the spotlight than he was. Their stories became more interesting than his. So he sort of got pushed to the side a little bit, and these other characters emerged. And so I just kept going with that. And after I did my thesis, I sort of sold it for parts, you know, as we would say in Detroit. I took some stories out, and they found homes in magazines. And then I just kept writing more stories that weren't exactly related to those of my thesis project. They were outside stories that were informed by, you know, life after the MFA. And it really wasn't until 2013 when I decided to try to put them into a collection. I was just writing them each separately as they came to me.
You have been around writers for years, but now that you have a legitimately published book, and I make the distinction because this is not a self-published book, this is a prize winner, but now that you have your own book, is there anything about the process of being a published writer that took you off guard?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it's sort of been a gradual process because it felt like in some ways that's when the real work began. So
yes, that's okay. You know, I should have just asked you that because that's what I was fishing for. Yeah.
Yeah. It has been wonderful. And to be honest, I've been so busy rewriting the stories to put them into their final form and promoting and everything that there are some people who I haven't even had a chance to tell yet. but those that I have, you know, including Franny Levine, Phil's wife, and of course Steve and other people have just been so terrific about, you know, I guess welcoming me to that next step and letting me know that they were happy to watch it progress all the way. So it is nice. I mean, it's nice to finally share the work with people. You know, I was a little hesitant about sharing things before they were ready. So now I can finally say, here, this is what you helped me do. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably the best part of it.
Yeah, when my first book came out, I was completely unprepared for what it means to be a published author, because I think I published my first book at a time when the culture, the literary culture for a writer was beginning to shift from you get a book published and then, you know, the book sells as you write your next book. And it's not like that anymore. You can't publish a book and then go on and write the other book. You have to publish a book and then go out and take care of that book for at least a year or two in order to make sure somebody reads it. How do you find that process itself, promoting your work, going to readings, setting up things, and basically being your own publicist?
Well, it's definitely a learning process, and you're right. I didn't know what to expect. I have spent a lot of time setting up readings, you know, which I'm still doing now, and promoting, and that's new for me. That's new territory, and it does sometimes mean, you know, spending less time writing the next book. But I just tried to accept that as, like you said, that's the way it is now, and it is very important. So, you know, I think a book, especially if it's, you know, if I am going to be able to publish a novel next, I think it does need more time than I probably think it does. And if this is what I'm supposed to be doing right now, then it's the right thing and I'm okay with it. And the novel is still moving along, just maybe not as quickly as I planned, but it'll get there, and it'll books kind of have their own time. You know, they have their own speed at which they need to enter the world and find
absolutely.
Their way to readers.
Absolutely. They have their own life. You know, when I, every time I publish a book, I try to take an entire year at least to promote the book. But after a year, I'm like, okay, what now? You know, I don't know what to do. You try to give the book a start. Let's talk about the book now. We're talking to Kristen Fitzpatrick. Her first book of stories called My Pulse is an Earthquake has just been released from an imprint from University of Virginia Press, is it?
West Virginia.
It's a beautiful book, and I want to talk about one of the things that really strikes me about this book that makes it really kind of powerful. There's a tension between this image of characters and lives that are, you know, frankly, just seem imagistically to be really nice lives, but there's this tension and this desperation and ugliness that underlines everything. And I'll give you an example, because maybe I'm not being very clear what I'm talking about. In the story, in Canis Major, you have this really wonderful family that loves each other, but the images of what they do, they train dogs to kill rabbits, and you always see these really ugly images of these dogs killing and this blood, but it's all part of this nice family at the same time. And so it's like this tension between these images that should be somehow comfortable and happy, but there's not. There's this underlining tension. Where do you get this perspective, this tension, this darkness?
I mean, I think, you know, whatever I read, all the great stuff that I read usually has that in it. You know, I think that's how life is a lot. On the surface, we are happy and we are loving, but you can't really get away from whatever evils have to exist in your life. I mean, for them, breeding these dogs and possibly training them to kill and allowing, you know, they're Rottweilers, so allowing their sort of killer instinct to come out is part of the reality of this life of dogs, because they really love these dogs. But you can't deny that a Rottweiler can kill you if he wants to. So I think you have this wonderful family, you have this life, and you love each other, but there's always going to be something that could kill you at any moment.
it sounds like, you know, like on one hand, here's a Norman Rockwell image, but instead of the cop looking down and smiling at the kid, the cop is shooting the kid in the head.
Well, if you let him. If you let it get there. Yeah, I guess.
No, I'm just saying these stories are dark, and what's really wonderful, you get away with such darkness because in among the darkness, there's just this wonderful, calm language, these beautiful images, and you know, there really is a lot of love in these characters. You get away with it. You get away with being dark without being Cormac McCarthy.
I mean, now that you mention it, it is told through the eyes of a child, so maybe I wanted to look at it through an innocent perspective, and maybe, you know, I wanted to show that she was discovering this darkness that maybe she wasn't aware of before. So, I don't know. Maybe that's part of it.
Well, and there's also another story, Queen City Playhouse, which is really a fantastic story. It's a high school cast and crew are set to perform The Tempest, and throughout rehearsals and throughout the entire process, there is a man dying backstage. That is a weird, wonderful story. How did that one come along?
I think it came about through a few different things that kind of converged together. sometimes I don't realize until later, you know, the things I've been watching or reading are really working on me. But I had been, again, you know, back to that original thesis project I had when I was developing this character. I spent a lot of time choosing characters' names. They have to be just right, and they have to mean something, and they have to have, you know, they have to fit the character.
Right.
And I decided, you know, one day that Miranda was going to be a name for a character, and so I decided I needed to make sure. And so I looked up Miranda, and I was, you know, sort of drawn into the Miranda character of The Tempest, and I started thinking more about her. And so then later on, I wanted to play with the Prospero, the magician, the trickster, and so on. And I think that the notion of a character like Prospero can really go places. You can really do a lot with a character like that. So I don't know. I just decided that I wanted to play with those two characters. And I had actually witnessed a rehearsal of a community theater production that just went all wrong. It was a disaster. And I thought, wow, this is really an interesting world that I have never explored before. And so I just decided that I wanted to do that. And then I realized that I had watched a movie by Garrison Keillor about the last radio show that they were doing in the theater. I think it's just called Prairie Home Companion. And I remember, you know, after I had written this story, I remembered that there was that character, that cowboy character that dies in the dressing room. And I thought, oh, no, I've stolen Garrison Keillor's idea. But then I realized, you know, if I make it different enough, maybe it's okay. So I just love that idea that while we're doing this happy, wonderful thing, you know, there's just something that we're trying to hide. It's terrible that's happening right there at the same time.
Do you know what's going to happen in your stories, or are you surprised as you're writing them?
Oh, definitely. It's full of surprises. I try to be really organized, really orderly, and then the characters take over and do whatever they want. So it helps me. It feels like I have control if I start with a plan. And sometimes I do start with the ending, and I write the ending first. So pretty early on, I know where it's going to end, or I know the final line. The final image, usually, but I just don't know how I'm going to get there. So.
Oh, that's brilliant that you know the final image. I mean, most writers that I talk to, they tell me the same thing. They don't know what's going to happen, but they have a final image, and it makes sense to me to have that final image before you start writing. In fact, I would say that having the final image and nothing else is even a great way to start. How do you start a story?
Oh, it's a mess. I just start, you know, I'm doing something else and characters will just sort of appear and the story just kind of comes. And then this wonderful synchronicity happens where I'm going about my daily life and things come at me and they find their way into the story, names and images and sounds and, you know, interesting people I see that become characters. And it just sort of comes together when I'm at that point. I don't know how to describe it. And then I make a lot of notes for a long time before I even worry about writing the pages of the story.
Oh, wow.
I figure out what scenes it needs or what pieces it needs, and then I break them up and I write them out of order. And then,
that surprises me. You write them out of order. Do you ever get tempted to allow the out of order unfolding of a story be the narrative structure?
That's a good idea. I don't know. I have definitely literally, you know, taken the pieces of paper and rearranged them and put scenes in different order. But I think that's something that those are a couple of things that I think you taught us, is to, you know, think about that final image and the power that a final image can hold. And I think you told us about writing nonlinearly sometimes, because there's nothing worse than just staring at a blank page one.
Well, what I love about these stories, and I, you know, I admit I'm kind of what some people would consider a literary snob, you know, especially when it comes to short stories and poetry, because I think there's a craft, you know, that allows us to go places in the literary landscape that if you don't understand and if you don't work towards mastering or work towards mastery, because I don't think we ever ultimately can completely dominate the beast of creativity. But as you work towards the mastering of the craft, especially in fiction, you tend to create, I think, stories that have depth because the characters have depth. That a story is, well, I'll tell you what Steve Yarbrough said to me one time. I told him, I was a student, I was still an undergrad, I think it was my first fiction class, and he thought I was talented, and he, you know, he was very encouraging. I came to his office one time and said, "Steve, I have an idea for a story." And he goes, "Oh, there's your problem right there. Don't have an idea. Have a character." You know, and even though that's what I meant, because, you know, when I said an idea, you know, but I understood what he meant. And your stories, they don't seem like the narrative at all is forced. It seems like the narrative is completely, the language is completely willing to just submit to the character and the character's need. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. But yeah, the character, I mean, thank you, by the way. It's a very high compliment to hear that the characters drive the stories. I think that, yeah, I mean, you know, Rose Ellen Brown says that writing is acting, inhabit your role. And I always think of that. If I am this person, what would I do? How would I say that? And so I just try to become them. And it doesn't have to be driven by the narrative or the plot. It's just their experience and this day or this week in their life and how it's going to ruin them or save them. And yeah, I mean, I definitely interview characters before I send them on their adventures. I make sure I know their history. I write a whole timeline. And so hopefully that helps to develop them enough to let the story be character driven.
Yeah, you know, I had a professor at University of Oregon, a fiction writing professor when I was getting my MFA there, who told us, he wrote an equation on the board, and the equation was P equals CH over T, which is plot equals character over time, that the plot is created by a character in, you know, over time that character will create the plot, as opposed to a character being dragged through the plot, you know, to, you know, get the needs out. But you have really incredibly well-rounded characters, and your language also oftentimes just disappears, you know, which is really wonderful. It disappears, yet at the same time, it's always there, like this white noise, this hum in the background. Do you ever find, as a writer, especially one who has such command of language that you do, and probably, I would imagine, you read poetry, do you ever find that sometimes you have to just hold back on the language because it's getting too aware of itself?
Yeah, I definitely struggled with that, especially in the early drafts of the stories. I got carried away with the language, and that was a criticism that I got in workshop quite a bit, is, you know, put the poetry on a diet and just tell the story, someone said to me. So that was difficult, but I knew that the stories were much better for it, because if your reader is getting lost in the language and they don't understand what's going on, the language isn't really serving any purpose either. So I understood the utility in being more spare and just being clear.
Well, it's a lovely book. It's called My Pulse is an Earthquake, Stories by Christian Fitzpatrick. I wanted to ask you just briefly, because we're running out of time. You say part of this was your MFA thesis. I teach in an MFA program, and I direct so many theses, so I know the process can be, you know, absorbing. But one of the things that one has to do when one submits a thesis to the graduate school is to put their thesis, their book, their manuscript into some sort of literary or critical context. And I'd like to ask you, where would you put this book in terms of, among what writers would you say you are connected to, or what writers are your kind of ancestral or even contemporary influences?
Oh, thank you. That reminds me of when you told us to find our antepasados and
yes,
in class, and I immediately went home and thought, who are they? And I wrote them down. I think, you know, so many writers have been so helpful, and I go back to them over and over. So if I could call them my antepasados, definitely Chekhov. You know, I spent a whole year reading one story of his a day, and it took 40 stories. And then after I got to 40, I would just go the next day and start at one. So he's someone that I hold close. Flannery O'Connor, Alice Munro, you know, all the people you might encounter in a workshop. I also really like to read people who are kind of up and coming, you know, names that nobody has ever heard of. I find that really inspiring to read new stuff, first books and so on. As far as poets go, I like Lee Young Lee. I listen to him a lot. And Carver, Hemingway. As far as contemporary, Stuart Dybeck, I think, has been really influential to me, especially during the writing of these stories.
It makes sense that that Flannery O'Connor, Raymond Carver, Chekhov, because they're masters of the short story form, the character-based short story form. And that certainly seems to be what's happening. Like I said, these are really character-based stories, and you care about the characters. They have a lot of depth, and they're leading this book. And I imagine that there were times when you got obsessed with particular characters, and they wouldn't leave you alone.
Yes, Absolutely.
Well, congratulations on a beautiful book. My Pulse is an Earthquake by Kristen Fitzpatrick. Kristen, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It was my pleasure.